Looked on her and the coming I thought I remember to that second side of the tape.
I'd like to give you a little story of the time when my father brought us up here in 1905. The first big fire occurred September 4th, as I mentioned before, when the Red Light District, where the fire had originated, had burnt all the north end of town from Lanesway up as far as the City Hall, taking the saloons and much of the Red Light District. Well, while the saloons were being rebuilt, my father one morning said to us, you youngsters after school hour, each take a gunny sack and go down behind the saloons and pick up these nice chips that are so good for making fire in the mornings. So we did, but there happened to be a big board fence along the Red Light District, and we saw this opening. We didn't know where we were going, and we went through the opening and found ourselves right in the midst of things. We noticed these little greenhouses, rows upon rows of them, that hadn't been touched by the conflagration, and we'd noticed the name Lulu, Julia, Rose, Violet above each door, and we were so taken up with these names that it was a while before we noticed a woman sitting in the window of each of these little greenhouses with her hair done in the old Florida style of that period, with a big curve over the shoulder, highly rouged cheeks, and a little piece of black passepartout down on the chin, representing a mole. And we thought they were about the most beautiful folks we had ever laid eyes on. And you might realize the startled look on these women's faces when they saw us youngsters roaming through their premises. Well, we got behind the saloons and picked up a lot of chips, filled up the sacks, and went home, same way we had come. And when our dad came home for dinner that night, we asked him who were those beautiful women who were living in the little greenhouses. Well, I think I just remember my father smiling, but I know that he never sent us after another sack of chips. In those early years, even though it was before we came to Alaska in 1905, where I figured by that time Nome was quite a respectable community, there were a number of Belgian women who had been brought under white slavery up to Nome. Oh, I have heard the number given, either 100 or 200 of them. And they were placed behind the board fence in the Red Light District. And it was surprising how many of these women were married by professional men, businessmen, mining men, and became a very fine, orderly women of our community. I think where they were so young, and at the time that they were taken over here, that many of them probably didn't know where they were going or what was to be done with them. Years later, I remember a relative of mine saying, "Why, you seem to be a decent woman, Carrie. How is it that we always understood that the women in Nome in the early years were all bad women?" I didn't stop to think what she was driving at. It was this fact of these women who were brought in white slavery. Now, when I attended the international reunion of sourdoughs in August 1957 and happened to be up on one of the floors of the Olympic Hotel waiting for the elevator, one of the old sourdoughs who was waiting for the elevator at the same time said to me that he had come up on the boat that brought these women to Nome. He was the one who told me that it was between 100 and 200 women that were brought here and sold at a tremendous price. If I remember rightly, it was something like $100,000. The man who had made the sale, I believe his name was Lucky Baldwin. Going back to those early years, I remember what we call the 400 Society of Nome. That also consisted of a number of your professional people here, the doctors especially and the lawyers, who were married and had their families here. And they had very nice homes
dressed very lovely for that period. You remember the long dresses and the bottleneck waistline. And I also remember as a girl when many of these 400s, as we call them, had Chinese cooks in their homes. In later years, we had an editor here, the Nome Industrial Worker, who always was poking fun at the 400 Society of Nome. He called them the Tomcat Society of Nome. Would make mention of them in his newspaper, especially under local items. When my father had decided to come back to New York from Nome here to bring us back with him, he had seen very little of us in 8 years' time, or from the time he left in 1897 for the Klondike Gold Rush up until 1905, when he came out after us. At the time, as children, we didn't realize how fortunate we were that he held a family together and had enough love and feeling for us to come out after us and bring us to Nome. Nor did we realize, until we became grown men and women, what it meant to be brought to a country like Alaska with its vast open spaces and its freedom that we wouldn't have enjoyed back in crowded New York City, where we were born and raised up to the time we came to Nome.
Mrs. McLean, your mother passed away 6 months before you came to Alaska, did she not?
Yes.
So that your father had the complete raising of you after you arrived.
He did. Right from the time that he brought us until 1910, when he met our future stepmother.
Now, did you, you were telling me about Jimmy Doolittle a few minutes ago.
Yes.
Was he in your class?
Yes, he was in my classroom in the fifth grade when I was in the sixth grade. And I well remember Jimmy in his little short pants that were the vogue of the day. They were little knee pants, just coming up to the knees, and he had quite a shock of hair that he fails to have now. curly hair, and always a twinkle in his eye. I happened to meet James after the war here in Nome, and I told him the only thing that remained of him, as I remembered him as a boy, was the twinkle in his eye. He came up with his folks in 1900, and his mother took in washing, his father was a carpenter, and James often helped to bring the washing around to the folks and also delivered papers. So he did, like many of the children here, many of the white children, he helped the folks along with the financial part of the picture. Do you want to make an introduction? No. Something that might interest you would be our mail service in the early years. Two boats a month meant quite regular mail service in the summer months for Nome. Before the Alaska Railroad was built, winter mail arrived by boat to Valdez and was taken by horse team to Fairbanks. From there it was transported by dog team to points along the Yukon and on to Inuit Creek, which was the dispersing place for Seward Peninsula. They figured that it took 3 weeks by dog team for mail to reach Nome, mail coming about twice a week with 1,000 pounds carried each time. But this mail was not all for Nome, as there were waypoints down the coast and up the coast that were serviced by other mail carriers. Up the coast, a carrier from Nome brought mail to Teller, York, Wales, and Shishmaref, and this was over one of the most blizzardy areas in this part of Alaska, also one of the most hazardous in the fall before the freeze-up and in the spring at the break-up. I talked to one of the last carriers who had that route, and that was Pete Olson, who is now out in the States. and he was the one who impressed on me what it meant in the fall of the year and in the spring of the year, when the snow would probably be gone, so he couldn't take the trail over the mountains, especially there where the York Hills are located, and would have to take the coastline. And where the York Hills are, it's almost an abrupt plateau that comes right down to the almost to the water's edge. Mm-hmm. And if your ice was insecure, it just meant hazard for the mail, for the driver.
The overflow was bad there too.
Yes. Then there was a carrier to the Kugrak, stopping at the various mining camps en route. This was not nearly the hazardous route that this other one was. Then there was a carrier that took mail to Solomon and Council and waypoints, while another team left Unalakleet, touching at Chaktulik, Bonanza, Koyuk, Haycock, Candle, and Kotzebue. These carriers just went twice a month, and that was enough. Twice a month, mail service existed through the winter months, beginning in November and ending in the fore part of May. Intrepid was the name for these mail carriers, for they faced any and all kinds of weather and had to travel on schedule. None of us can realize the hardships of the trail only by experiencing them. I found that one trip through the winter was sufficient. Then figure no less than 6.5 months of twice a month schedule, and you have some idea what they faced up with. Anyone who subscribed for magazines and newspapers was out of luck in receiving them in rotation. Sacks of mail would be stacked up in the warehouse at Unalakleet, and when the sleds were piled up with the mail going north, the sacks would be taken at random. Partial post that had not been granted by Congress until 1911 was a futile undertaking. You were lucky to get your package by spring. At no time was the Unalakleet warehouse cleared of this winter mail by spring, and special dispensation often was made to get this mail by boat to its destination. Nomites well remember when the small coastwise steamship Carwin arrived in the roadstead about May 24th to the 28th, laden with tons of mail, as well as oranges, lemons, and grapefruit, and eggs. Oh. I don't know which was received with more enthusiasm, the mail or the fresh stuff. She carried mail that was detained in the Seattle post office after the mail was no longer sent north for winter delivery. You see, it would pile up.
Yes.
The month of May, for instance, and probably even April mail wouldn't be sent down because your breakup would stop the drivers, mail carriers, from driving their dog teams. When the Carwin no longer made the run, the U.S. revenue cutter Bear brought us tons of mail. This even into later years, before the planes were consigned to carry second class and parcel post. Even inasmuch as Nome had twice a week winter mail service, if you had an answer to your letter written in November, by spring, you were doing well. Mail clerks were not under as much pressure as they are today with the plain mail.
Mrs. McLean, when did they have wireless or telegraph in here?
Oh, they had that first down at Port Safety, as they called it, about 22 miles from here. And that was, at least by the inception of our mining camp here, Nome, if not earlier.
So that you could wire.
Oh, yes, yes.
And get wires in.
That's right.
You didn't feel quite as isolated then.
No, because certainly we didn't get anywhere through the mail.
No. I've often thought of the poor mail carriers in the spring and winter Sears and Roebuck and Montgomery Ward catalogs. That heavy weight.
Well, those generally came on the revenue cutter, the Bear, in the spring, or on the Carwin.
Oh.
And even though it was a little late, still it gave you time to get your order in on the first boats coming in June.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
For a few minutes.
When I was in Haycock at Dime Creek, I would watch the mail teams as they came up from Unalakleet on their way to Candle and Kotzebue. And the teams were no less than 18 dogs, all of them bearing a capacity load. Because the trip was such a lengthy one, it was handled by two mail carriers, so that as one would leave, he generally met the other mail carrier coming back from Kotzebue on his way south. Up until when I was there in 1915, teaching school, I had the children make a guess when the mail team would get in, and generally had a box of candy for the one who was the lucky guesser. And we always knew when the team was coming because he would take the lagoon trail right behind the town of Teller, and we could hear him howling at his dogs and often coming in when there would be such a blizzard blowing that you couldn't see your hand before your face.
Mrs. McLean, could you tell us a little something of the Spanish influenza epidemic?
You mean the flu that occurred in
1918? Yes, that's right.
Well, I can give you a little idea of the flu in this part of Alaska. It so happened that Dad Williams, an old-timer in Nome, who used to have a hothouse, had gone out to the States taking a quantity of ivory relics with him and managed to sell them on the boat as he went out, and he decided to return to Nome and get more ivory. Well, he returned just as the flu was playing havoc in the States, and he got the flu and died either aboard the boat or as soon as he reached Nome. And some say then that he was the one who brought the flu to Nome. Others again say it originated at Fort Davis, just 3.5 miles south of Nome, or east of Nome, when a bunch of live chickens were landed there.
Oh.
But I never could see the comparison there, how the chickens would be bringing the flu. But anyway, it evidently cropped up down at Fort Davis the same time it did in Nome. Dr. Burson, the army doctor, was called in to handle our civilian cases because Dr. Newman, who was our ANS doctor, was very ill with it. And I don't know at the time if there were other civilian doctors here, but I do know that Dr. Burson, the army doctor, was the one who had to handle the situation here in Nome. The Holy Cross Hospital had been closed in 1917, but it had to be reopened at the time of the flu because there were so many sick here in Nome, and it seemed that we didn't have the nurses, we didn't have the personnel that had been with the Holy Cross Hospital prior. So it took the well folks to look after the sick. It was the coldest November on record. It was 51 below zero, and there was no snow to bank up the houses. It was just one of those dry, exceedingly cold falls, which didn't help the flu situation. Five had died aboard the last boat that had left Nome for Seattle, and many sick were taken to the Seattle hospital in ambulances off that boat. Here in Nome, there were a number of civilians who died, even up in the hospital and in their homes, in spite of what little care they were able to get. Many, many natives died who feared it and had no resistance to it. They would get pneumonia, and they didn't know how to
take care of themselves.
And in fact, one native had hung himself here.
Oh, real fear of it.
A long pit over 100 feet long was dug on the beach just below the embankment where the old graveyard stands above the sand spit, where the native bodies were buried en masse. There were two places that I know of that did not get the flu. At Shishmaref, John Paul Jones and his daughter Holly were teaching there, and they put a sentry on the east end of town and the west end of town and allowed no one to come or go, and they were saved getting the flu. And that's why Shishmaref has remained one of our largest villages, too, up in this part of Alaska. Haycock was another place. It seemed that the mail teams were not coming in. The people were getting alarmed, wondering what was wrong. So they sent two white men up to a place called First Chance. I forget just how many miles, but it's a number of miles, to tap the telephone line and find out what was wrong. They did and learned of the influenza. And so there was nobody coming or leaving Haycock, and that town never got the 1918 flu either. At the telemission, Mrs. Fassel, wife of the missionary, had to look after the mission dog team, which was a large dog team, and after her family. She was the only one who was not ill in the mission house there. The native people in the surrounding villages all died, and their starving dogs got into the shacks, and more than one body was dismembered. A pit 70 feet long was dug near the mission for burial of these bodies. When I returned in 1920 from the States, I missed all the natives, both at the mission and at the teller, that I knew in 1915. They were taken almost to a man by the flu. Albert Bernhardt, a squaw man, when able to travel, drove to the village to see his wife's parents. He found both dead, and his own 5-year-old daughter, who had been taken by the grandparents. You know how the native people do. Often if there's a large family, they take a child or two to raise. Was in a sleeping bag, slowly freezing to death. The grandparents had presence of mind when ill to place her in a sleeping bag. Gangrene had set in the child's legs, and the father took her to Nome, where one leg was amputated to the hip and the other one above the knee. He told me never did he want to experience a tragedy of this kind again. The suffering of those child, those 3 days on the trail, he says, was unbearable. There were two York people in our teller trying to look after the sick. As soon as the flu began to mitigate a little, teams were sent to all the villages to help the living and to bury the dead. I believe it was sent, as I remember, through the court, through the courthouse, the judicial setup. I guess that's all that I have on that. We had a storm here in 1913 that paralleled the storm of 1900, probably making just as much destruction as it did there in 1900, though at that time there was far more coal and lumber and merchandise that was still along the beach and had not been removed, you see. This storm occurred on October 3rd, 1913, on a Sunday, and the water rose so fast that it swept over much of the sand spit, and Nome looked almost like an island for the river and the creek as they were rising so rapidly. The wagon bridge from Nome over to the sand spit was declared unsafe, and the residents on the sand spit ordered to hurry and cross over to town. The last ones crossed at 11:30 p.m., and the bridge went out by midnight. Oh. The city bathhouse that was built almost on the beach, very close to the fire department, the city hall, was a building 2.5 stories high. And by midnight, nothing was left of that but splintered wood. A roomer on the top floor, who had gone to get his belongings, said that between the enormous waves and the big rocks pelted against the building, nothing could have withstood it. A safe was carried 1/4 mile by the surf. 13 sandspit cabins and 11 pianos were counted in Snake River at one time. The sandspit and the east end of town were the hardest hit. If the waves didn't make the shambles of the shacks, they filled the houses with sand and gravel right to the ceiling. You should have seen some of it. I have a lot of pictures of that.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, oh, any number. With tangled electric wires on Front Street, there was that hazard to the men who were working desperately to remove the merchandise and household goods belonging and household belongings from the buildings on South Front Street, not to mention a fire hazard. But there were no lives lost, but property damage was terrific. Another thing it did, many people who lost their homes left for the States on the last boat. This high water, you might say, as much as any of the Nome fires, had helped to destroy the last vestige of Nome of the gold rush. You see, your Sanspit had houses that flanked each side of Gold Avenue, and some of the homes were just as nice as anyone would wish for. And running water had been piped over there, and they had electricity. So it was just as nice living over on the Sanspit as in the heart of Nome. The Pacific Coast Storage Company had a large building on the Sanspit, and though part of the building remained standing, the whole back portion that housed the coal storage was destroyed, and crates of chickens and boxes of bacon and hams were swept into the river and eventually lodged themselves near the homes on Belmont Point. And so everybody had a hard time. The waves were so high and devastating that a portion of the embankment of the old graveyard just west of the Sanspit was washed away, exposing the coffins. One coffin was sent floating down the beach and somehow got into the river and lodged itself over here on Belmont Point. I guess it's the way the wind and the current carried it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One coffin was sent floating down the beach into the river that held the body of a dance hall girl by the name of Goldie, who lost her life here in 1900 in a shooting scrape. It was remarked by some old-timers who saw the body that she looked just as natural as the day of burial.
From the cold temperature in the ground.
That's right. Uh-huh. See, the body was frozen.
Yes.
In Tella, located 85 miles northwest of Nome, the water was hip-deep in the lower end of town, and the people were hurriedly taken to an old shack on a low hill above the town across the lagoon, which was becoming a mass of big waves. The people, young and old, were housed in this incommodious place, was the only name for it, the whole night, feeling fortunate to have even that. In Nome, there was still a last boat of the season to come with provisions and building materials, but nothing meant for so much discouragement and a general evacuation of many old-timers who lost their homes, who might otherwise have remained. Mm-hmm. I tell you, there was nothing like that storm that just put a blotch on things. You felt it.
Well, of course. All the things you treasured, and imagine your piano and everything being taken.
All went.
Now that part of the of Nome, too, it has never been underwater before, had it? Never taken a beating from the waves.
Only as it was visited by the 1900 storm, and old-timers claimed that this was on a par with that one.
Oh, yes.
And of course, we've had storms since, but there was so much in 1913 in the path of the storm, where there were houses built along the beach down at the east end, and then all these buildings on the Sanspit, that they just were swept away. Mm-hmm. I graduated from high school here in Nome in 1913, after attending school here from the fifth grade on, and after working in the telephone office for almost 2 years, I had heard that there was an opening for the teacher's position in the Teller School. It seems that the year before, a woman from the States, middle-aged, had been so discontented putting up with conditions and situations at Teller that she made life a burden for herself as well as the community. So the school board there vowed that they would get an Alaskan girl to teach up there. So when I found out about it, I took things in hand, decided to apply, and managed to get the school. I spent two happy years there, 1915 to the spring of 1917. Then I went out for 3 years to further my education and returned in 1920 and again taught in Teller for 2 years and then spent 1 year down at Haycock at Dime Creek. The following spring, June 1923, I married Mr. McLean, whom I had met up in Teller, and I changed my vocation. I went up to the dredge up at Windy Creek in the American River Country, and there I cooked for the crowd that summer. We spent two summers there, and then settled down in Nome when the children began to come. I had three daughters and one son born here in Nome, and have resided here, you might say, ever since, a matter of over 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mrs. McLean. It's been a pleasure having this interview with you, and I want to tell you now that we've all admired you for many years as being one of our very oldest and truest pioneers. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're entirely welcome. I hope I'm deserving of that.
Well, you surely are. I think so many people lean on you for information and for your cheerfulness that you impart to everyone who visits with you.
Thank you.